Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sunstone Podcast. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'm here to introduce this week's episode. It's becoming more and more common for children who are raised in rigidly religious homes to leave their religion when they become adults. Liz Brown McDonald interviewed 15 of these people for a study that she presented at the 2021 Sunstone Summer Symposium. She interviewed each of her subjects separately and was amazed at how many similarities their stories had. For example, the lengths that the children would go to cover up their disaffiliation with the church. The way that the parents would blame themselves for their children's disaffiliation. And, of course, the heartbreak that attended both the parents and the children. And then she ends up with some pretty interesting thoughts on what the church could do to reduce this suffering. This was one of our most popular sessions at the symposium, which is why I'm sharing it with you. If you'd like to purchase access to all of this year's symposium sessions, head over to sunstone.org/registration. I'm pleased to announce that you can deduct the cost of registration from your tithing. Your bishop just told me so.
I decided to do this project to examine the experience of conflict between active Orthodox LDS parents and their inactive disaffiliated young adult children. I came at this problem both as a student of psychology and as a parent coach and teacher. I've spent several years working with parents one-on-one as well as in groups and classes, and this study emerged out of that work. The problem that I set out to examine is in some ways unique to Utah and to Mormonism, but in many ways it's also universal. The difficulty that many parents face when their children reach adolescence and begin the very appropriate developmental work of individuating, of essentially telling their parents, "I am not you," it's universal. I've observed many similar themes between immigrant parents and their children who struggle to maintain connection when their Americanized children integrate perhaps too much, too well, too quickly, and can become something kind of foreign and frightening to their parents. My work began with a literature review. What are people talking about? They're talking about whether or not religion is transmissible between generations. And yes, it is. That's the answer. If you are religious, it's quite likely that your children, or more likely, I will say, that your children will also be religious. And then, of course, the Pew American Survey every year shows that each generation is less religious than the previous one. People are also looking at the impact of religion on parenting practices. Does it help parenting or does it hinder parenting? And again, the answer is yes, it does both. So it depends on what we do with it and how we use it. Some studies show that religion may be correlated to better parenting practices, specifically with more warmth and more consistency. And the exception that shows up in a lot of studies is the more conservative religion, the less likely it is to be beneficial. And that is thought to be because conservative religion often emphasizes obedience rather than autonomy. And BYU published a study maybe 10 years ago, I don't remember exactly when, that shows that when religious is successfully shared between generations, it can have a really positive impact on families. And that seems self-evident. And so then my question is just, well, what if the transmission fails? What if there is not a shared religion between generations? And what's the impact? There is one more study that talks about how different it is to leave a covenantal religion. So a religion which is not, it's high demand. It's not just rooted in Sunday sort of practice. It's rooted in your daily life more. And rooted in the idea that the congregants are making covenants between God, which are moderated by some sort of religious leader. And subjects within that study compared the experience of leaving their religion to feeling as if they had moved to a different country where they didn't speak the language or understand the customs. I heard lots of similar things from my subjects in my study, that as young adults, they were overwhelmed with all that they didn't know about how to navigate life in a non-Mormon world. I did a qualitative study, which just means long format, open-ended questions, rather than a survey or something with a shorter format. Because qualitative research takes so long, it's really time intensive, and so the sample sizes tend to be quite small. I ended up with 15 subjects and a waiting list a mile long because lots and lots of people wanted to have a chance to share their stories. I used a convenient sample, meaning I just recruited mostly students and former students from UVU who were around me. And I used a grounded theory approach, which just means that I didn't have a hypothesis or a thesis going into it. I wasn't testing anything. I was just letting people share what was the kind of what's the biggest deal for them. And so I had 5 questions, which I asked, and it really was pretty straightforward. Moving from what was your relationship like to faith and religion growing up? What is it like now? And what was your relationship to your parents like growing up? And what is it like now? And then I asked, you know, sort of deepening questions for clarification. If someone said that they were forced to go to church as a child, I would say, well, what did that look like? How did it show up? But really, it was the subjects guiding the conversation more than I was. I had 15 subjects. They were all between the ages of 21 and 30. 9 were male, 5 were female, 1 was transgender female, 8 married, 2 engaged. I think kind of remarkably, 14 had parents who were still married to each other. And at first I thought that that was surprising. And then when I thought about what I was looking at with this really rigid religious worldview, I thought, well, maybe it's not surprising. Maybe that should be obvious that that's who would show up here. So saturating themes. This is how we talk about qualitative research and what showed up for almost everyone. And so these experiences that I'm going to talk about next really saturated the sample, meaning that 100% of the subjects talked about some version of these experiences. I want to emphasize that this sample was recruited because they had conflict with their parents, and that not all people who have sort of mixed affiliation and mixed faith families do experience this type of conflict. The first theme, which was really prevalent for my subjects, was that they perceived that their parents were disconnected. And they seemed to be disconnected in 3 distinct ways, which I want to talk about. The first was that they seemed to be disconnected from a sense of self. Children perceived that their parents' values, desires, intuitions, emotions, and their own sense of worthiness and belonging was essentially outsourced to an external identity. And that was sort of just coming straight down the pipeline from the LDS Church. For example, just one illustration of this was one subject who grew up in California said that in 2008, her parents canvassed for Prop 8, which would essentially ban gay marriage in the state, in spite of the fact that they had gay friends and had previously been vocally opposed to this piece of legislation. When local leaders asked for their help and support, they just showed up and went to work. Another subject, a 28-year-old female, said, "Mormons emphasize listening to the Holy Ghost and just disregarding your own feelings about everything. It's like what you want doesn't matter." Many subjects described parents whose lives were consumed by a sense of duty. Parents prioritized church-related commitments. The parents obviously chose to participate in and prioritize those activities, but they did consume a huge chunk of free time, which kind of necessarily eliminated opportunities for other sorts of activities, including maybe things that could have been more connective for these children. The impact was deeply felt for most of my subjects. What they observed was that other things seemed to be more important than what their parents want or how they felt, and more important than the time that they could spend with their children. These parents also seem to be, again in their children's eyes, disconnected from others. This feature is in many ways a direct result of the disconnection from self that I described above. A lot of these subjects were actively seeking connection to parents who essentially had no self to connect to. There was nobody home on the other side of that relationship who could reach back and show up authentically because the disconnection from self was so thorough. Many subjects talked about dads who knew how to preside but not connect. They described incredibly formal parent-child relationships where the only time they talked to their dad in particular was in like the home office or the front room, like the home teaching room, right? Conversations with dad that like they would only ever talk to their dad in this really formal environment where they would open and close the conversation with a prayer. And oftentimes the conversation wasn't a conversation, it was an interview. I had more than one subject who talked about having regular PPIs, and I didn't know what that meant. Do you guys know? Personal priesthood interview. Weirdly, I never had one of those. Just really interesting. Most subjects talked about a general lack of affection, either physical or verbal, in their homes or both, where they grew up, and a lack of willingness or ability to talk about difficult feelings such as hurt and anger. These participants described either one or both parents having never inquired about what they do for work or for fun, how dating or marriage relationships were going, or anything else really that wasn't directly related to church activity. And this was in stark contrast to the persistent questions that they would get from parents about which ward they were in and what their local leaders were like and what their callings were. So it wasn't that the parents weren't interested in their lives, it's that the parents were interested in a really limited range of topics, which were no longer relevant or really a part of these kids' lives. A third form of disconnection was disconnection from the present moment and sort of a sense that their parents were living out of time and preoccupied with eternity. One subject, a 28-year-old woman who was the youngest in her family, said, "It makes me really sad that my parents feel like failures. All of their kids are so interesting, really interesting, talented people. I wish that they could feel like they've been successful with their children. I was their last hope, and I feel really bad that I didn't live up to it. I know for them, it's really serious. It's this eternal consequence. But I feel like if they could lose that anxiety over not being with their family in the future, everyone could be much happier right now." Another subject, who was a 29-year-old transgendered woman, said, "To my parents, I know it feels like losing eternity. My younger brother is still active, so they've shifted all their hopes and dreams to him now. I wish they'd put more priority on our relationship. One of the things that really bugs me about the church is how everyone is trained to be excited about the end, to just endure till the end when they can die and go to heaven together. It robs a lot of the luster from relationships." And one 22-year-old woman said pretty simply, "I don't know how to comfort them anymore when we're together. I'm sitting right there at Sunday dinner and they're acting like I've died." These LDS parents also shared a certainty in their rightness about the exclusive truth claims that belong to the LDS church, and a lack of curiosity about other worldviews and perspectives. This certainty was triggered particularly in response to a child who was experiencing a faith crisis or faith transition, as my subjects were. And it would be kind of a thoughtless reaction where kind of a wall would go up and conversations seemed to be completely non-productive and often combative. Most of these parents had never asked why their children were struggling with faith or expected behavior such as attending church. One subject, who was a 25-year-old man, said, "I try to put myself in my parents' mindset and remember where they're coming from, but it seems so unfair that members can be upfront with their views, but the people who have left are expected to swallow their thoughts and feelings. Why can dad be direct with me, but when I'm direct in response, I'm labeled as angry? In the church, you're taught that you have the only correct way of thinking, the only truth, so you don't need to be respectful of others' views. I wish it were more open and more respectful so that we could have complex conversations that don't end up just explaining each other's perspectives away." These subjects also all described pretty specific, rigid external parameters around expected behavior, which would be worthy of the love of God and the love of parents, which for especially young children are one and the same. They really can't distinguish between the two. And they spoke of this unattainable ideal of worthiness and then a persistent and deep sense of shame when they kind of inevitably failed to live up to these expectations of perfection. It left children feeling unworthy of love, struggling with shame and disconnection, and without any sense of belonging in the context of their families and their church community. A 29-year-old subject spent Sundays dressing in church clothes, and we were just dying laughing, but it's sad, like it's funny and sad. And this, he was not the only one. He was just maybe the most extreme flavor of this. So he spent years of Sundays dressing in church clothes, complete with a white undershirt, so it would look like he was wearing temple garments. He would look up the lessons online and like research. He was working harder probably than like the person teaching the lesson, just so that he could cover his bases when he went to dinner with his parents and make it look like he had gone and he knew what the lesson was supposed to be about. What he said about that was, "I spent so much time and energy trying to fit into a mold of what I was supposed to be for them. All anybody wants is loving acceptance. It shouldn't be so hard to get it." A 27-year-old female described it this way, "I feel pressured now to be good in all of these other ways, to be good enough, because I know I screwed this up for my mom. I worked hard for a lot of years to like myself, and I do now, and I feel proud of what I'm doing in my life, and I get excited, and I want to share it with them. But I know that they'll never quite see it. I always have this underlying feeling that whatever I'm doing, it isn't quite good enough. I know they love me, but it makes me feel bad that they're disappointed, that there's something missing and that I'll never actually meet their expectations. I know that their love for me will always be qualified. And a 22-year-old woman said the same thing in fewer words and just said, I wish that the unconditional love I learned about in church was real. There's a fourth theme, which didn't have 100% saturation within my sample, but it was too common not to sort of discuss here, and that was the element of heightened risk. This feels really important to me to discuss because of how many LDS parents see adherence and obedience to gospel principles as a sort of like safety or insurance policy, like a safety plan. Like we can protect our children more by teaching them to be obedient to church expectations. More than a third of the subjects within my study reported having repeated sexual activity during their teen years without any access to protection. This is on the one level a really practical problem, because if you grow up on the Wasatch Front, which most of my subjects did, buying condoms is incredibly risky because you might bump into somebody at the grocery store. You might know everyone who works at the grocery store. They might know your parents. They might say something. And so it's just a really calculated risk for most of these subjects who knew. It's not that they were unaware that this was unsafe, but they chose to risk sort of unwanted pregnancy and STIs and STDs rather than risking their parents finding out that they were sexually active. On a deeper level, this is kind of heartbreaking for me because it reveals a lost opportunity for connection and support in really important and meaningful phases of development and high-stakes decision-making, such as making informed and smart choices around early sexual experiences. One subject talked about how heartbreaking it was to have to conceal the most important person in his life. It was a girlfriend that he had for over 2 years, through most of high school, and his parents never met her. She was a complete secret. What we're asking of our kids in these scenarios is for them to fracture their sense of self in order to keep us comfortable. I was talking about this phenomenon with a friend who's working on her PhD, and when I mentioned the risk of unwanted pregnancy and STIs, she just said, you can get a Z-Pak for chlamydia, but you can't get an antibiotic for a fractured and disintegrating sense of self. All right, risk number two. Two-thirds of the women that I interviewed had tolerated abusive patterns from boyfriends and or bishops around consensual sexual activity. This is really troubling for me. This showed up in a handful of ways, the first being that many of the women in my study heard repeated messaging, which would displace the worthiness of the man onto the shoulders of the woman. Boyfriends would berate women after sexual activity for seducing or tempting them, for making them unworthy. That was language that came up a lot with a lot of my subjects. One woman talked about being directly and explicitly blamed when her boyfriend had to delay leaving on his mission as if it had not been an ongoing consensual relationship. Bishops would unwittingly, I hope, reinforce this abuse by again displacing the responsibility for the worthiness of the man onto the shoulders of the woman. And these women heard bishops say things like, you could have lost him his temple recommend. You could have gotten him excommunicated. This reveals the deeply kind of, or the externalized locus of control, which so many members of the LDS faith community share, that we aren't really capable of making our own choices. And when we make mistakes, it's so uncomfortable that we kind of look around for how we can displace the shame or guilt and just blame someone else. Risk number three was just lying and hiding lifestyle choices and how that complicated getting appropriate medical care and mental health care. For example, one woman described being in the ER with her dad, and when the doctor asked her if she was sexually active, a question which had direct bearing on her getting the appropriate medical care that she needed, she lied to protect her dad from the truth that she was sexually active and to protect their relationship. Several subjects described hiding mental health difficulties such as depression or anxiety, which they were experiencing in part due to the loss of support and love from their parents. They reported overcompensating and always presenting a completely cheerful facade to parents, since they worried that their parents would blame any kind of challenge or struggle on the fact that they had left the church, almost anticipating that the parents will feel that they're getting what they deserve. Erik Erikson was a prominent 20th century psychologist, and he theorized that human development is formed over the lifespan by these tensions, trust and mistrust, sort of these tasks that need to be mastered at a specific phase of development. Until we've mastered one, we can't really move on to the next one. The age ranges are loose. Obviously, not everyone masters the task of trust versus mistrust between birth and 18 months, but that's the idea. The central challenges for the kids in my study are here in the teenage years. They're highlighted. So identity and role confusion between the ages of 13 and 21. And then the challenge of intimacy versus isolation between ages 21 and 39. The idea of a double bind describes a kind of paralysis that we all face when we're unable to choose well because the cost of either choice is so potentially so high. So in the teen years, during this phase when we're struggling between identity and role confusion, just to clarify, role confusion is basically an unresolved question of, am I a child or am I an adult? Can I start to identify separately from my parents? What happens when I signal to them that I am separate? Am I safe in pursuing my own differentiation? Risking individuation, development seeking, and identity building are vital tasks to the process of maturing and becoming an adult. Avoiding that development in order to maintain approval or connection to caregivers and community will leave a child stuck in role confusion. And then in the adult years, the early adult years between kind of 21 and 39, we have intimacy versus isolation. Intimacy, of course, requires seeing and being seen and knowing and being known. You have to know something about yourself in order to have intimacy with another human being. You have to be willing to risk exposure and possible rejection. For the kids in my study, risking authenticity and honesty could result in a greater capacity for intimacy and integration. But the risk, of course, was that it could backfire and increase isolation in some ways, particularly through the loss of community support and parent approval. Showing more of ourselves can feel risky and can be incredibly costly. If parts of what we reveal are rejected, it can lead to more compartmentalization rather than less, and ultimately to a disorganized sense of self, which will need ongoing management, such as lying, hiding, and essentially orphaning what we come to feel are the worst or most unlovable parts of ourselves, the opposite of integration and wholeness, which is the ultimate goal within this model of human development. As I was looking at these findings, I started to wonder, why? Why are the parents reacting this way? What are they hearing? And how might rhetoric from the church and its leadership be driving this type of reaction in the parents? Here's one rhetorical pattern that I found. And to be perfectly frank, I'm not a super attentive listener. I've never been great at listening to conference. I've been inactive for the past decade of my life. And so while some of this surprised me, it will likely not surprise many of you. And so I'm just going to kind of go through what I found that maybe explains a little bit of the parents' reactions. And a lot of it probably will sound familiar to you. So there's this promise that the sealing power of temple ordinances extends to the children of worthy or perfect enough parents. This teaching started with Joseph Smith, and it's been reinforced by every modern leader since then, from Brigham Young to Russell M. Nelson. The promise is that all children will ultimately be saved if parents are worthy, good enough, perfect enough. The language changes, but the messaging stays the same. The idea is that parents can, that it's possible, and should, that it's their responsibility to teach their children into heaven. And that if someone is struggling, the solution is outside of the relationship. It's to have more family home evening, more scripture study, more family prayer, basically more indoctrination. So if we are taught that perfect enough or good enough examples will save our children, the natural and inevitable outcome of this teaching is that we will parent from a place of invulnerability and disconnection. This would mean that we should never let our children see us struggle or grapple with our own faith or our own relationship to God. James E. Faust reinforced this invulnerability when he said, "If parents misbehave and stray, even temporarily, some of their children may be prone to take license from that example." So in other words, struggling parents better present sort of a false, perfect front for their children and present invulnerability, present rigidity intentionally. We can't afford to be human in front of our children, or they could be lost literally forever. The stakes are so high. And how did this look in my study? A 25-year-old woman said, "My mom believes that all children raised in the gospel will return. The only sadness I have about leaving the church is knowing that I've broken her heart. A lot of times I imagine my family never having been in the church, and I long for that. It's really hard for me to think about how the church has hindered my family. Overall, the church has made us less close and put all these unnecessary divides in place." And a 29-year-old man said, "Dad feels like he's failed as a parent. The one role he was given by the church, he just hasn't completed successfully in his mind." I don't think that there's any reality in which he'd be willing to question the truth claims, and so he'll just take this burden of guilt and failure to his grave. It breaks my heart. The church doesn't teach any scenario in which someone who leaves isn't rejecting God and choosing to sin. So Dad can't stop trying to rescue us. And here's the end of the quote that kind of started it from Joseph Smith. Pray for your careless and disobedient children. Hold on to them with your faith. I don't know how you all feel about framing children who may have a different worldview or a different set of values as careless and obedient, but it feels not very respectful to me. Not very loving, not very godly. And hold on to them with your faith. There's nothing objectionable in this language except for the way that it plays out. The way that really, like, what's wrong with it, the problem here is how it shows up for the kids, like the kids in my study. A 12-year-old, or nope, subject 12, who was a 26-year-old man, said, Dad beats himself up. As patriarch of the family, he feels responsible that I've fallen away. Both my parents beat themselves up. They feel like they've done something wrong. All they talk about is, if only we had done more family home evening. Mom will say stuff like that all the time. She also says stuff like, well, I just hope I can get you with me in the next life. Okay, here's the other half of the rhetorical patterns that is really interesting and maybe problematic. A quick Google search of conference talks and Ensign articles reveals a litany of pretty insulting words that describe people who doubt and people who leave. Lazy, careless, sinful, wayward, faithless, contrary, worldly, selfish, deceitful, deceived, defiant. I could make 19 slides just of the harmful language that describes people who leave. I think there's a false equivalence. I think we're conflating wayward, disobedient, deceived, whatever, all of those synonyms with inactive. I hope that that's not the intended equivalent, but it's never clear that it's open to an alternative interpretation. It also assumes that we all agree about what is good, that what is right for one of us is right for all of us, and some of us are just too lazy to follow through. Russell M. Nelson said salvation is an individual matter, but exaltation is a family matter. So much pressure. This is just so much pressure to be placing on children. We're placing, I think the church leadership's rhetoric is placing the pressure on the parents, and the parents are sort of like displacing that pressure into their relationship and onto their children because of fear. I just don't see any way that this line of thinking is going to end well for families. And here's another interesting quote. David Bednar said, devoted discipleship is the best and only solution to every question or challenge. Again, there's plenty of plausible deniability here in these words, except that devoted discipleship to this type of rigid adherent means one thing, and it means tithe-paying temple recommend holder. I think it's problematic to suggest that if we are devoted enough, we will stop having questions and challenges, which is sort of the inverse of this. Again, we're going back to the idea of the gospel or religion as an insurance policy or as a safety plan, that we can avoid hardships and avoid the challenges of life by playing it safe, by being obedient, by being good enough, having enough family home evening, having enough family prayer. I was surprised again and again and again to see how many of the thoughts and fears expressed by the parents of my subjects were fueled so explicitly by church leadership. In-group versus out-group. Unhealed ego, which, to use the Mormon vernacular, I think we could say is the natural man. It wants one thing. And what it wants is not bad, but what it wants is safety. And so when we think about what ego looks like when it's out in the world on the prowl, it's looking for safety and security. There's nothing more safe, there's nothing more secure than certainty, a claim of certainty. One of the most fundamental ways that humans look for safety is through being part of an in-group. Remember middle school? Remember, like, so much of middle school in-group signaling relied on, like, wearing the right kind of jeans, right? And then we get older and we come to Sunstone and we might signal which in-group we're part of by, like, are we covering our shoulders? Are we dropping a swear word into a conversation casually? And so we can signal with the same gesture or the same clothing that we're not in this in-group, but we're claiming belonging in this other in-group. People who talk this way, and church leaders who employ this kind of language routinely are essentially trying to herd us all towards safety and certainty. And this is not a bad thing. I'm just not certain that that it's of the highest value. And it certainly is counter to development and growth and what I think it takes to become godlike, which is one of the best parts of being Mormon. Okay, so we're going to play a little game. Guess who? Guess who said this? The time is coming when those who do not obey the Lord will be separated from those who do. Our safest insurance, he just says that, just right there. Our safest insurance is to continue to be worthy of admission to his holy house. As parents, we have the same obligation to teach obedience that our heavenly parents felt obliged to teach us. While we can teach the need for tolerance of others' differences, we cannot tolerate their infractions of the laws of God. This is so problematic for me. So we can teach tolerance, but we can't actually be tolerant. We can teach our children that they should suffer, be long-suffering, if other people have different sets of values from you. But it's up to us to discern and judge other people's infractions against the laws of God. Really problematic. Love songs perpetuate the false hope that love is all you need if you want to be together forever. Don't even get me. If you pick a fight with John Lennon, you pick a fight with me. That's absolutely not. Divine love cannot be called unconditional. Did you guys know that? The word unconditional does not appear in the scriptures. When you complete your mortal probation and enter the spirit world, you will be brought face to face with the heart-wrenching question, where is my family? And this last quote follows a paragraph in which the speaker is describing the terror of not knowing where your children are within the apocalyptic, smoldering, burnt-out hellscape of the fires in Paradise, California. Russell M. Nelson might be the king of the in-group. This is his favorite line of rhetoric. And again, I want to acknowledge the potentially good intention behind this, that he's steering a very large ship. He's trying to herd his congregation and his followers towards safety. I'm just not sure that it's having his desired outcome. Good or bad, whatever the intentions, wherever the intentions are, the impact is kids who I see on a regular basis who are suicidal because they are human. The impact is children whose most earnest prayers are pleas with God to fix them, to help them to be happy on the inside of this group that is not working for them. Kids who have panic attacks every time they set foot in the church building when their internal guidance systems are firing off every alarm they can find, calling attention to the fact that something here actually doesn't align for them. And then at age 21, 22, 23, 35, and beyond, when I talk to them and ask them if we could wave a magic wand and fix this so there wasn't a problem and the conflict with your parents went away, what would it look like for you? These kids often say things like, I just wish I could be happy back on the inside. As if the problem is in them. Because within this context, that is the only possibility. The only possibility, if what you're hearing in church, in conference, and from all of these external authorities, if that doesn't resonate for you and doesn't work for you, it doesn't align with you, then you are the problem. I wish that President Nelson would be more responsible with the enormous platform that he has. He has a population of eager listeners who are willing and determined to make sense of everything that comes out of his mouth. Knowing about his medical career and knowing that for many people, he is literally the mouthpiece of God, I would think that he would take some care to follow the Hippocratic Oath and first do no harm. I would hope that he would recognize how incredibly vulnerable his most obedient followers are. These are the people, the parents in my study, are his best listeners and his most enthusiastic followers. When things like this come out of his mouth, the impact is harm. The impact is parents calling their children up, sobbing, brokenhearted, and terrified that they're going to be separated in the afterlife. I didn't realize until I looked up all of these patterns of rhetoric that are so prevalent throughout Mormon discourse, just how small and mean this version of the Mormon God is. Part of what is so troubling to me is that every single person that I talked to in my study, without exception, didn't leave because they were careless. They left because they cared. For every single one of them, it was the only way that they could stay in tune and aligned with their own values. It was not an absence of values that led them away. It was integration, development, and choosing to align and act from their values. To sum it up, it is a disturbing kind of violence which is seeping out of this kind of language. To speak these words to people who believe that you speak for God is violent. To speak these words with a soft voice and a gentle smile makes it worse, not better. It makes it more confusing, and it makes it easier to believe that your intentions might outweigh the harmful impact of the words that you are saying. This should sound familiar, even to me. I've even heard this one. One of the most famous quotes that pertains to parenting from a modern prophet, David O. McKay, said, "No other success can compensate for failure in the home." I'm going to add to that the language from the family, A Proclamation to the World, which says, "Parents have a sacred responsibility to teach their children to observe the commandments of God. Mothers and fathers will be held accountable before God for the discharge of these obligations." Again, there's plenty of plausible deniability. I don't disagree with either of these in terms of the words that are being used. There's nothing objectionable here unless you know how this will be interpreted. If we are interested in avoiding the pain of families being destroyed routinely on our watch because of harmful rhetoric, we must acknowledge not just the potentially benign or positive intentions, but the actual impact it's having on families. I would suggest that this is a highly pressured and disastrous setup for parenting. This is life and death. It's all outcome orientation, black and white thinking, and literally displaces the burden for salvation of the children onto the shoulders of the parents. While listening to many of my subject stories and while listening to friends recount parents' behavior just in casual conversations, it would be easy to dismiss these over-the-top reactions as a one-off, as if those are the anomaly. But when we look at these reactions as part of a very predictable pattern, which they are, and connect the dots, we can see that this kind of worldview is actually being reinforced over and over again by church leaders. I don't think we can continue to play dumb and pretend that we don't understand where these reactions are coming from, or go blind to what is driving them. Did anybody see last week there was an article in the New York Times about women's temple garments? Anybody see that? Yeah, some nods. The last sentence in the article said something like, either get into the underwear business or get out of it. Like, either figure out what you're doing or like leave us alone and let us buy our own underwear. I thought that was so funny. And it's how I feel about parenting. It's how I feel about family welfare too. I think if we want to continue to claim to be an organization which prioritizes family relationships, so much so that one of the main selling points for baptism is the idea that we can be together forever with our children, then we must be more careful and more mindful about the harm that is being done by continuing to sow seeds of fear and panic regarding who gets to be in the in-group and who does not. So if parents are mature, differentiated, and have a sense of self outside of the institutional religion, they might handle a child's faith transition better. But what if their identity is merged or fused? What that might look like is low differentiation in the parents, where the values, the authority, the desires have all been outsourced. Low development, where personal agency has all been surrendered. Here's the problem with super conservative religious parenting is a high valuation of obedience. And for children, this means that the choice point where the parents chose to do this way is so long ago, the kids never see you make the choice. So what they perceive is we're doing this because it's right. And it looks very much just like an external checklist of obedience. And then the second half of that is a low valuation of autonomy, where autonomy is not prized. And of course, these parents would be very easily threatened by kids who don't surrender their own agency as easily as they did. And in this worldview, for this parent, rejection of the church is personal. And this explains something that a lot of my subjects talked about, that they said, it feels so personal to my parents. They feel like I'm rejecting them, but I'm not. But if your identity is so merged with the institution, then it's personal. And that's exactly what it would feel like, I think. All right, we're going to talk for a second about outsourced values. So this is kind of the idea that the choice point happened a long time ago. We do this because we got baptized. We do this because, you know, our kids, maybe they don't even know. So here's just an example. The teaching, your body is a temple. The understood expectation there is that we don't use drugs, alcohol, or have premarital sex. But what else might our kids hear when we say this? They'll hear, it is not your home. They'll hear, it does not belong to you. They'll hear that male authorities, not you, get to determine who has access to it. They'll hear that it must be kept pristine and beautiful and flawless, perhaps. Which, did anybody see the billboard? I think it was in Draper last year, that showed the Salt Lake Temple in scaffolding. And it said something like, "The Lord is remodeling his temple. Isn't it time to remodel yours?" And it was for plastic surgery. So someone has noticed that this is the under the table messaging that's going on with your body as a temple. And someone's making some money on that, I think. This is an incredibly problematic framework. I don't think I even need to say for teaching consent and respect, particularly in an institution where women have no visible authority to assess their own worthiness or to refuse access to their bodies from this place. So what might it look like then when a child rejects religion and decides to assert bodily autonomy? I think it might look like desecration. There's a temple. Maybe it's time to destroy it. And I think depending on how wounded or how foolish or how hurt, how ashamed and how rejected these people feel, it might look like adults who are stuck in a reaction to parents forever just because they don't ever feel like they can fully claim autonomy and ownership of their own bodies. I have a question about whether or not obedience is of value in adults. If so, under what circumstances, for what purpose, is it godly? Does it create godlike individuals? How might it contribute to the prosperity gospel worldview? The prosperity gospel worldview, Heavenly Father wants to bless us. He's just waiting for us to repent or be worthy or learn a lesson. You can kind of fill in the blank there. There are lots of things that can go there. The idea here is that Heavenly Father is bound by certain laws and how he can bless us. He can only bless us if we're worthy. If he isn't blessing us or answering prayers the way that we want, we are doing something wrong. His love for us is unconditional, but his treatment of us can be kind of managed by choosing the right. The problem, in case that's not bad enough, I think the inverse is even more problematic. People who struggle deserve it. People who are blessed have earned it through their righteousness. This worldview will inevitably breed judgment rather than compassion for people who are suffering or struggling. And there's no acknowledgement of atonement or grace. All the emphasis is on our own striving, our own hard work, our own attainment. So what are we saying about the nature of God from this place? I went to a meditation teacher one time who talked about this God as a big gumball machine in the sky, which is why I have a gumball machine up there. But I thought that was pretty good, that we sort of like, we figure out what we have to put in to get the gumballs to come out. We're cultivating the idea here that love is transactional, that relationships are just a series of transactions, that our value is contingent upon our behavior, and that obedience is the condition necessary for love and belonging. With that in mind, we're going to revisit Erik Erikson. This is basically Erikson's recipe for a mature, integrated, self-actualized adult. So the words in bold on the left: trust, autonomy, initiative, industry, identity, intimacy, generativity, and ego integrity. I don't see obedience. I don't see any synonyms for obedience on this list. And then valuing obedience over autonomy actually depends on maintaining the weaknesses or the challenges. It depends on maintaining people in a stunted developmental place, rooted in mistrust, shame and doubt, guilt, inferiority, role confusion, isolation, stagnation, and despair. So homegrown values, how can we start to integrate what has maybe previously been outsourced for us? We can identify our own values. We need to figure out what's most important to us and why. If you don't know, I would suggest you could ask your children when you're feeling really brave and strong. You could go to your children and say, "What do you think is the most important to me? What do they notice us spending our time, our money, and our attention on? What do we talk about? How do we speak to and about each other? Are these behaviors consistent with our stated values, or do we need to be brought into more alignment?" Secondly, we can align. We can do the work of sort of aligning and making sure that the decisions that we're making, the ways that we're behaving, are actually coming from a place of our own internalized values. And then we can connect with our children and share the why. Why are these things so important to us? We can communicate why they're important. We can use vulnerable, open communication and tell stories, age-appropriate stories, of course. And we can take responsibility for potential triggers. And this is particularly important when we're working with our children around issues of sexuality, modesty, and those kinds of like developmental milestones, because whatever we haven't done the work to sort of integrate and heal, whatever harm was done to us, if we're uncomfortable with our own sexuality, it's going to be really, really hard to be the mature parent who can help guide our children to a mature picture of their sexuality. And lastly, we can trust each other. The goal here is not that our children will adopt our values, it's that they will sort of digest them and transmute them and come up with a value system that is deeply their own. We can allow our children and our neighbors and others to have their own experience of the world. When we are deeply connected to our own values, we can help our children connect to theirs, and we can be curious about their experience in the world and help them figure out what's important to them. And we can continue to make decisions based on our own values. Anna Dea Judith wrote a really interesting book called Eastern Body, Western Mind. And in it, she says that religion negates spirituality when it becomes a structure for the following things: denying our feelings, avoiding the challenges of life, controlling others, and ego inflating righteousness. I think this is just a good metric for evaluating what we're doing with our religion, with our spirituality, and how we're using it, and whether it's working for us. Church leadership could better support healthy relationships and healthy development in a number of ways, but some ideas are they could develop a more compassionate framing of doubters, leavers, and non-members. They could depressurize parent-child relationships and clarify what is really a parent's responsibility and what is not. They could help to increase our collective understanding of agency. They could increase and model trust in others to be the experts on their own lives. And they could increase and model real faith in the atonement of Jesus Christ, not as the backup plan, but as the plan. If we're claiming to be a Christian religion, I think it's really important that we actually trust the atonement to do the work for us and don't believe that we need to be perfect and that the plan is like, oh, try not to mess up, try not to use the atonement. If you have to, it's there for you. That doesn't seem very Christian to me. American poet Archibald MacLeish famously said, "Religion is at its best when it makes us ask hard questions of ourselves, and religion is at its worst when it deludes us into thinking that we have the answers for everybody else." For me, I think the greatest gift that we can give to our children is ourselves, our hard-won authenticity. Our kids want to know us, but we have to get to know ourselves first. What might it look like if we examined our relationship to our culture, to our religion, to our history, to our God, and offered that full, rich picture to our children? What if we could bring the choice point forward through time so that rather than saying we do this or that because we were born or baptized into this tradition, we show our kids that I'm choosing to do this because it brings me so much personal joy and fulfillment. For example, we attend church on Sundays, which I don't, but you could say this if you did. We attend church on Sundays because I love singing hymns with our neighbors and worshiping God with others who share in our faith. What if we could examine our collective Mormon history and fully name and catalog what we are proud of and what triggers our shame? What about our current doctrines, policies, and practices do you love the most? What about our current doctrines, policies, and practices are you most troubled by? How do you see others being blessed? How do you see others being harmed? This examination, accounting, and inventorying is the work of developing selfhood, of identity building, and of bringing home our values and ideals. This is the work of integration, of bringing home the parts of ourselves and our pasts, our personal histories, and our shared history that we have orphaned and disowned because they are maybe unsavory to us or because we wish that things could have been different. If our children perceive that modern leaders are worthy of our reverence because they are perfect, how will they relate to that without a sense of unworthiness and inherent shame in their own flawed humanity? How do they see us relating to ourselves? Do we let them see us, or do we try to show them the perfect example, resulting in all of the disowning, the fragmenting, and the disorganized sense of self that we project in hopes that they will go blind to our weaknesses? What we are asking of our kids when we do this is to go blind. We're asking them to choose not to see what they see in us, in our culture, in our traditions. We're asking them to choose not to trust what they feel and to choose not to know what they know, which leaves our children in a very, very precarious and vulnerable spot. If we want to heal our religious community, we must heal our families. We can and we must offer them something better, something more real. It is my belief that our children don't need external systems and structures and organized religion. But if that is what we are offering to them, we need to do it from a place of deep examination, integration, and accountability. Our kids need connection. To close, I'm going to introduce you to my youngest son. He's 12 now. His name's Emerson. And I have his permission. He hates. I don't ever put anything about him on Instagram or anything because he hates it. But he told me I could use his picture for this. He's 12. And I often look at this picture to help me remember who I am parenting. It's good to remember that this little guy with the gapped teeth and the enormous head and all of the heart-stoppingly hilarious facial expressions is still in this now big, tall body with the hairy legs. It's a good reminder for when he's out of sorts, or let's be honest, for when I'm out of sorts and need a reminder about how important this parenting stuff is. He doesn't need me to be perfect, but he does need me to be accountable for my behavior and for my choices, and especially for what I'm choosing to bring into our home and into our family and into his life. Our children need connection to themselves, to their intuition, to their own internal guidance systems, and they need our permission to do that. It helps if they have even more than permission. It helps if they have our curiosity and our encouragement to do that, to see what they see, to feel what they feel, and to know what they know. They need connection to us, to our authentic selves, to a mature grown-up parent. That grown-up parent is one who is working on their own development and differentiation and working hard to maintain loving relationships by striving to model accountability and hold appropriate boundaries. And I believe that most humans do better when they develop a faith in something that is bigger and more perfect than we, their very flawed parents, are. For some parents, that may be God, a being whose love is still perfect and whole, even when we, their parents, have hurt them or let them down. For others, it may be fostering a deep connection to the beauty of the natural world, or to the goodness of humanity, or to beauty of human expression through art or music or dance. Whatever it is for you, find your own faith and cultivate it and share it with your children in the most intimate and personal ways that you can dream up. Show them what lights you up, what infuriates you, and why the world and the people in it are worth fighting for. Let's remember what I heard from one young woman in my study, the 21-year-old who said, "I just wish that unconditional love was real." I think we can show her and our children and one another that it is. Thank you so much for listening.